It's doubtful many people other than those who've attended Columbia University have ever heard of Dr. Nicholas Murray Butler. But when he was president of that school, he was a national celebrity, advising presidents and running the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, among other things. Now, Michael Rosenthal has written a book about him called Nicholas Miraculous, The Amazing Career of the Redoubtable Dr. Nicholas Murray Butler. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased it has brought Michael Rosenthal back to my show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
So who gave him the nickname Nicholas Miraculous?
That was Teddy Roosevelt.
Was he really miraculous?
He was. He was miraculous. He really wanted to run the world, and he had to settle for running Columbia, but he had intergalactic aspirations for himself.
And he was quite famous at the time. An international statesman, won a Nobel Prize, ran for president. How serious was that?
It was very serious in his mind. He had a fair amount of contempt for Woodrow Wilson, and felt that if Woodrow Wilson could be president, why couldn't he be president?
Princeton and Columbia.
Well, that was the problem, that the country had decided that it was enough of one university president. So he really didn't have a chance. But from his point of view, he thought that he could manage by virtue of his own intelligence and his own public relations capacity.
Any irony in the fact that the man who replaced him after 44 years was Dwight D. Eisenhower, who did leave Columbia to become president of the United States?
That's amusing. No, Butler finally came around to agreeing that Eisenhower was sufficiently distinguished to follow Butler. He was concerned that his provost, whom he called his clerk, Frank Fackenthal, might succeed him, which would have been a demeaning thing for Butler. So he was pleased with Eisenhower.
He wrote books, hundreds of articles, was the president of Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, president of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, chairman of the Carnegie Corporation's Board of Trustees, all the time running and building the university. With all those activities, did his responsibilities at Columbia ever get lost in the shuffle?
Sure they did. After he lost to Warren Harding, in his mind, and didn't become president of the United States, which is, he always thought Columbia was the second most important job in the world, president of the United States being the first. He, I think, began to lose interest in Columbia a little bit. When he became president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, he had a kind of international platform for himself. So things began to fall by the wayside a little bit.
But what about during the Depression, when everybody fell on hard times? Didn't he have to devote a lot of energy to keeping a university together?
He did, and he did a fair amount of successful budget cutting, and the university survived in one sense, but not in another. There was no period. There was no real leadership. I think Butler effectively stopped being an accomplished president sometime in the 30s.
He was reluctant to talk about his family life, but what and who influenced him?
Well, he was married in the 1890s to a young woman whom he was quite attached to. She died in 1903. And in 1907, he married Kate LaMontagne, who was a sort of no-nonsense woman whom his family detested, and she detested the family. And she wouldn't let Butler have any family members come to his house. He had to make all the appointments had to be made in the office. And when Kate married Butler, she said that she wanted him to become a great man, and the best way she could accomplish that was by amputating him from the Butler family, which she successfully did.
And obviously it worked.
It did work.
Perhaps he would have done as well if he had maintained some relations with his family. He had attended Columbia College as a student. What was the school like then?
He went to Columbia in 1878. It was a tiny school on Park Avenue. In his class, there were 78 students who entered and 48 who graduated. And it wasn't much of a place intellectually. He himself thought it was a kind of children's school where you simply spewed back the lessons that you learned from your professor. So there was not really much serious intellectual life.
Is it true that into the late 1880s, America didn't really have any universities, or maybe only had one?
Yes. Part of Butler's extraordinary success was his latching on to what was really the great growth industry of America, which was education. In 1876, Johns Hopkins was founded as the first genuine research university. And prior to that time, there had been none. So Butler somehow intuitively understood where the action was. And
But this is different than Harvard, Yale, and Princeton?
Harvard, Yale, and Princeton were not research universities until Hopkins invented the notion. Mm-hmm. And then Butler took Columbia when he became president in 1902 and simply flogged it and inspired it and directed it into becoming a great research university.
But his predecessor, Frederick Barnard, obviously we know what school was named after him.
Right.
He became a mentor to Butler, didn't he?
Yes, he sold Butler on the educational life that Butler led. Butler always had a great tropism for the rich and the important and the famous, and he discovered Barnard when he was a student, and Barnard discovered him and inspired him to go into education.
So what kind of philosophy did Butler bring to education?
He brought no particular pedagogic philosophy. He brought a passion for understanding the needs for a research university and for making Columbia into this sort of center of learning that would fertilize the world.
And why was that? Was he so eager to transform Columbia?
Well, I think he was eager to transform. His vision was that Columbia could be a fertilizing influence like the Acropolis, which was in a sense, an absurd notion that a 16.8 piece of real estate on Morningside Heights could be that.
And they I remember years ago still hearing this is the Acropolis of the Upper West Side.
Well, that was Butler's vision, and he was derided by some people for such an obviously preposterous notion of excess. But the point is that if you believe things like that, you help make the place, bring the place to that point. And Butler was one of the roles which Butler understood intuitively of university president was to be a kind of creator of a heroic mythology which would drive the university. And Butler was really the Homer of heroic mythologies. And so he made by claiming that Columbia would be greater than it could possibly be, he made Columbia, in fact, what it was.
You say he was the Homer. He was, but Homer was not as much of a self-promoter.
Well, no one was.
As Butler.
No one was. Butler was a master of controlling the press. He was a brilliant speaker. He could speak about anything. One of his friends said to hear Butler speak was like listening to a symphony orchestra. And he was a massive manipulator of the press. Adolf Ox of the Times loved Butler, and Butler would tell Adolf Ox what he wanted to cover and how Adolf Ox should cover it, and Ox made sure the Times did that. So he was a genius at self-promotion.
He sent copies of an address he was giving to 9,000 people to, like President Roosevelt, state governors, foreign newspapers. That is serious self-promotion.
Only 9,000, Leonard, yeah. Only 9,000. Yes, he knew how to...
And they were all interested in what he had to say?
Well, he made sure that they were. He was a master of not only of public relations, but of saturation. He understood the virtues of saturation. So he would send anything. The Times would print his Christmas greetings to the world, which he would publish every year.
Michael Rosenthal is Roberta and William Campbell Professor of the Humanities at Columbia University, author of several other books, including The Character Factory, Baden-Powell's Boy Scouts, and The Imperatives of Empire. I should have remembered you came here to talk about that book some years ago. Do you see any similarities between Baden-Powell and Butler?
Indeed. Two empire builders. Two people who made themselves into institutions in the process of making their own institutions great.
But there's a difference in that Baden-Powell is still remembered by an awful lot of people, and Butler is largely forgotten.
Butler made the mistake of living too long and living past his relevance, so that by the time he died in 1947, people had both forgotten Butler, and what they remembered of Butler was a man who was blind and deaf and had sort of lost his impetus.
Well, he'd also invented his own celebrity. That has less lasting value than if other people decide that you're a celebrity.
Totally. While he was alive, he was his own press, his own best, although he had two press agents working for him, he was his own best press agent. And he kept on pumping himself into any day in which he didn't appear in the front page of some newspaper was a bad day for Butler. And there are very few of those. He always managed to get himself out there.
to the point where he won a Nobel Prize in 1931, shared it with Jane Addams.
Yes.
Everybody remembers Jane Addams.
Right, right. Yes. He became a sort of the spokesman for the Kellogg-Briand Pact of Paris, which called for the renunciation of war as the instrument of national policy. And he didn't initiate the idea, but he pushed it, and then he used that as a means of gaining the prize for himself.
And also averted us going into war. There was never a World War II.
Exactly, exactly. He actually took quite seriously the notion that countries were going to do this. And while everybody was busy signing the document and then arming, Butler kept on saying this was a watershed in human history and we don't need to have large navies because there's no more need for anybody to be concerned about war. So he missed that one pretty badly.
How did his association with Andrew Carnegie begin?
Well, he was traveling to Drexel University in J.P. Morgan's railroad car and had a brief conversation with Carnegie. And as I said, he always knew how to kiss up to the rich and powerful. So he wrote to Carnegie saying he would like a few minutes of his time to discuss some educational issues that they were both interested in. And Carnegie said yes, and that was all Butler needed. And so Butler at that point convinced Carnegie that he was the man to watch. And in fact, Carnegie was totally devoted to Butler. He was one of Carnegie had a group of close friends called Old Shoes, and Butler was included amongst them.
And the Endowment for International Peace grew out of that?
Yes, yes.
And is that the reason he wound up advising seven presidents? Obviously, they thought he was an expert on foreign affairs.
Well, Walter Winchell said that Warren Harding had said that what was confusing about his foreign policy was there were two foreign policies. There was a foreign policy of the United States, and then there was Butler's foreign policy, and countries sometimes were confused as to which one was which. So he lost a lot of his power after. He was not fond of Harding, and he hated Hoover and Coolidge, and Roosevelt never really accepted him as a close friend, Franklin Roosevelt. But Teddy Roosevelt had been a dear friend of his.
Until
he betrayed Teddy Roosevelt in 1908, when Teddy gave a rather raucous speech to Congress attacking them for their pusillanimity and not wanting to defeat the corporations, the people who abused their wealth. And Butler wrote to Teddy saying that he shouldn't do that, presidents shouldn't address Congress that way. And Roosevelt never forgave him. But what Roosevelt didn't know is that Butler also sent some blind copies of his letter criticizing Roosevelt to Carnegie and other bankers, obviously trying to situate himself in the Republican Party, that once Roosevelt was gone, Butler would be there. So, that was the end of their relationship.
He, as you suggested, stayed way past the time that he should have at Columbia. He was blind and deaf.
Yes.
There had been people hinting that he should leave by 1937.
Yes.
How was he able to hold on for eight more years?
Well, it speaks to the position he had generated for himself. People were really afraid to tell him that he had to go. This was true both at Columbia and also at the Carnegie Endowment. After he finally was convinced in 1945 to step down from Columbia, the Carnegie trustees were eager to get him to go, and they designated Wild Bill Donovan, a World War I hero who had organized the OSS in World War II, to tell him, and Donovan couldn't do it. He said, I just could not go there and talk to Nicholas Murray Butler and tell him he had to step down.
What was your sense of Butler before you started researching this book?
I had no sense at all. I had a sense that this was a triple-barreled president who was stuffy and powerful. And what I discovered really was, for me, sort of the best-kept secret of the cultural secret of the first part of the century. I mean, he was everywhere. He knew everybody. He was respected. He was considered the foremost American of his day, which I had no idea about.
Well, in his review of your book in the New York Times Book Review, Thomas Mallon wondered aloud if you, I'm quoting, endured a long, depressing surprise as you learned more about Butler.
Yeah, no, quite the opposite. The more I learned about Butler, the more extraordinary he became, the more fascinating, the more multi-talented, So he was, I never lost interest in him. He was an extraordinary figure about whom people know very little.
And a part of the fascination here is, well, one, that he was connected with so many important people. So he, in a way, is another, he's in a way of telling some of the history of America and American education. But also, we wonder how somebody who was that famous has become so forgotten, other than the fact that there is a building named after him at Columbia. There's also one named after Seth Lowe, his predecessor.
Yes, well, Seth Lowe got it for the $1 million he gave to it.
He got a whole library.
Yes, the library, the Butler Library was built in 1934. It was called South Hall, and the trustees called it Butler Library in 1946.
There's an excerpt of Michael Rosenthal's book, Nicholas Miraculous, The Amazing Career of the Redoubtable Dr. Nicholas Murray Butler, in our reading room at that can be reached through quick links at wnyc.org. And Mr. Rosenthal will be giving a reading and signing books tomorrow at 6 o'clock at Columbia University's Lowe Library. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and it was a pleasure having you back.
Thank you, Leonard. Nice talking to you.